You are listening to the Friends of Fantasy Benefits Baseball Podcast. We will be coming to you each and every day with uncensored, in-depth analysis of everything you need to know to win your fantasy leagues this season. You can follow us on Twitter, at Fantasy Benefits, or join the Facebook discussion groups, www.facebook.com/groups/Friends of Fantasy Benefits. Give us a 5-star review on iTunes, and send us a copy or screenshot of it to friendsoffantasybenefits@gmail.com or on Twitter, at Fantasy Benefits, for a chance to get into one of our listener leagues or other prizes. Enjoy the show. We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits. Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
I mean, just because the rest of their outfield sucks doesn't mean they're going to sacrifice your control just to get a name everyone's heard of in there. I mean, they're nobody's going to those games, whether Lewis Brinson's playing or not. So,
we are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
I will crush them on air only because if and when they prove me wrong, it'll be like 4 or 5 years down the road, and we'll have all forgotten about this conversation.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Welcome to the Friends of Fantasy Benefits Baseball Podcast. I am Justin Mason, lead fantasy writer and analyst for friendsoffantasybenefits.com. Joining me on this episode are Mike and Matt. Matt, how you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm good. A bit hectic. Apologize, those who don't know, a little peek behind the curtain. I was fashionably late for the show today because work sucks, but ready to talk baseball. We got James on, great guest. I'm ready for it.
Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great. You know, there was breaking news that Brandon Moss was traded, so I'm just kind of diving into that and spending all my time just looking at the trade, analyzing that. So that's where I am.
exciting news in hot stove we live in these days.
Yep.
Joining us today is a fantastic special guest. It is James Anderson from rotowire.com. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. It's been a while, but happy to be on with you.
Yeah, James, I think it's been 2 seasons since we've had you on. It's way, way overdue.
It's messed up. Yeah. It's messed up, Justin. Not inviting him like that.
Yeah, who's in charge of it?
I have no idea. I believe Mike's in charge of scheduling. But
yeah, blame on this guy.
James is a fantastic prospect guy.
The guy that can't even come on his own podcast is in charge of scheduling.
Yeah, exactly. James, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself and what you do over at RotoWire?
Yeah, sure. I'm the lead prospect analyst. I've been in that role for going on, I think this is my fourth year where I've been in charge of the prospect rankings over there. We go 400 deep, 20 per team. So definitely kind of catering to the for dynasty leagues as well as single season owners. In the midst of pumping out some divisional prospect rankings, so lots of stuff for you if you're into prospects, and I assume you probably are if you're listening to this podcast.
We do love our prospect here. We are all about the potential that they have there. Just like Mike. Mike has a lot of potential. He always busts, but he has potential.
Yeah, just untapped. It's untapped.
All right. You can James, where can people reach you on social media?
On Twitter, at RealJRAnderson. And it's spelled exactly how it sounds.
All right. You can reach Matt on Twitter at MDTopFWFB, Mike on Twitter at MikeWarnerFWFB, me on Twitter at JustinMasonFWFB. Let's just jump right into it. We all took part in a dynasty draft, an industry league dynasty draft. 20 teams, 40-man rosters, 800 players. It was a slow draft that was extremely slow, but we got through it. We survived. And I think we all kind of took different approaches. So Mike and Matt shared a team. James, you shared a team with the illustrious Ian Kahn, who I'm a huge fan of. And then I went solo. But we'll start with you, James. What was your strategy, and do you feel like it worked?
I don't, you know, I didn't really have a, you know, a firm strategy going in. I think that you don't really want to pigeonhole yourself in a draft like this. There were some players, you know, as the first round started to unfold, because I didn't participate in the invisible hand, you know, where you can bid for specific draft slots. I value the 35 keepers year over year a little bit too much to sacrifice that. So I was just kind of at the mercy of some just random number drawings to pick 15th. So I was just kind of waiting for guys to fall to me. Like Ronald Acuna might fall. It looked like Manny Machado might fall. And when neither of them did, I had four or five guys I was considering there. Freddie Freeman ended up being the call just because I trust his skill set to age the best of these guys, and I trust to kind of be able to count on specific aspects of his skill set next 5-6 years. And from there, I still didn't really have like a firm, because I had to see how the angle was going to shake out. If multiple teams, you know, 2, 3, 4 teams had started going heavy on prospects early on, I'm not sure that we would have actually gone that route, maybe till 15th, 16th round. But it got to a point, 5th, 6th round, where it was still just Tom and Greg going after the top prospects, and they started to kind of rise to the top of my board just because we were kind of beating through some of the more trustworthy younger players, and it just seemed like a time to get in on those guys. So we kind of pivoted towards some guys like Bo Bichette, Lewis Brinson, Royce Lewis, who, you know, weren't targets necessarily, but they were just, you know, our top four or five players on our board at a certain point in the draft. So we ended up just kind of going that route, trying to take the best value we could, trying to take players really in every round where we either thought their value was going to stay constant over the next 4 or 5 years, or their value was going to increase over the next 4 or 5 years. So that was just the general philosophy, but there weren't really firm players that I like needed to have the first round or the second round or the third round to kind of make it all pan out or see what value would fall.
Mike, or actually Matt, you started off the draft without Mike as your co-owner. He came
right
on later, so I'll let you kind of lead this part of the discussion. Unless Mike has something he wants to jump in and say, what was your strategy and do you feel like it worked? Because you took kind of a middle approach between, I think, me and James.
Right. Yeah, I did. And for full disclosure, I picked one spot in front of James. And I, too, was, you know, I took Machado right before he took Freeman. I think he's mentioned somewhere he would have taken Machado over him.
Yes, that's accurate.
Yeah. And I was pretty happy to get Machado where I did, considering I, you know, it was picked in the latter half of the first round. But the way it fell, and with Tom and Greg pretty much emptying my queue of top prospects way sooner than I thought, I was looking at this draft, and I didn't find a lot of prospect hitter values I liked where they were going. So I ultimately didn't grab many offensive prospects toward later in the draft, which normally wouldn't have been my style. But like I said, I mean, you had a team – like James touched on, he had a team of Tom and Greg were just taking every literally top prospect off the board. And then that was also driving up the prices for other teams if they wanted to get a guy. And I didn't feel comfortable paying a lot of those prices with the talent we had on the board. I mean, I just tried to not really earth-shattering strategy, try to stay relatively young and grab the best player off the board. I mean, my first two picks were Machado and Votto. I think that's a pretty solid start to any dynasty draft. I know Votto's up there in age, but I mean, I think he's got a pretty safe skill set. And, you know, I added Mike halfway through the draft, and it was great because it was a good idea. He's nice. Obviously, Mike knows his shit, and it was fun to, you know, bounce ideas off of him and stuff. And we ended up with, I think, a pretty decent team. We should stay competitive, and I got to keep all my keepers. Like, you put all the value on the 35 keepers, and I think there's a ton of value in there. And I'm pretty happy with the way it ended up. Yeah, I wish we would have had, you know, maybe a different pick here or there, and I kept getting sniped early, man. The 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th round, I kept getting sniped. And then all of a sudden, I completely changed my tune. It was like, you know what, just go get my guy, whether it's early or not, because, you know, I had guys like Osuna who I targeted and stuff. I ended up with Domingo Santana, which I actually think I might have had the better off deal on that, because I think Santana's got the better power-speed combination and it fits my squad a little better. But I got sniped on quite a few players, and I was getting frustrated. But Dynasty format, go get your guy, man. Don't worry about all that.
And my strategy was is the strategy I use virtually in every Dynasty draft that I've ever been a part of, and that is I'm going to draft this like it's a redraft. I don't care about the future. Future's not guaranteed. I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. You know, the league could get hit by a bus tomorrow. Who knows? So I went after best player available regardless of age, pretty much how I would rank it for 2018 only. And I have very, very awful prospects to show for it. I mean, outside of, you know, a couple guys who I think could probably pop up later on, and I did pull the trigger on Zach Collins maybe a little bit earlier than I normally would, but it was part of kind of a catching strategy of taking Lucroy and then Collins, hoping I can trade one or the other if they both hit, and hopefully just one does. So I was not a huge fan of Tom and Greg's strategy, and I was very, very critical of it on social media. I definitely subtweeted the hell out of them at times. But I see why they're going for it. I just don't know how successful it will be in a league like this with such good talent in terms of owners. So I definitely want to win 2018, and I need to win 2018 because, unlike James and Matt, I put down, I think, 15 keepers on getting the number two draft slot, so I'm not going to get to keep 15 out of my 40 players. So that's going to hurt.
Yeah, I want to touch on something real quick too. I mentioned earlier I didn't find a lot of value in the offensive prospects. What I ended up doing is, you know, the old strategy, the don't pay for pitching prospects. Well, I kind of went against my adage there. I have on my squad, I have Alex Reyes, Michael Kopech, Sixto Sanchez, and Anderson Espinoza. I guess my theory on this was, once I took Reyes, I felt like I had to pair him with another high-end pitching prospect, because if one of them hits, it's still going to be a good value play, kind of hedging my bet a little bit. Actually, going all in is what I'm doing. And if I can get two out of four of those guys hit for where I drafted them, I think that's a win for me. Yeah, the odds are against it, but I kind of zigged where everyone else was zagging because the pitchers kept falling. And I was looking at my personal prospect list, and I think at one point, like, the top 10 guys available were all pitchers. And I couldn't let those guys fall any farther.
James, did you stay away from pitching prospects, or did you go after them as well?
We didn't really – we were sort of going off my prospect rankings, right? So, I mean, like, if it had just been me, we would have probably been leaning on him a little heavier, but I really value Ian's input on these guys. I mean, he knows the top prospects pretty well. And so we were kind of going, you know, a little bit, we'd skip over a guy here, skip over a guy there. The first pitching prospect we took was AJ Puck in the 11th round. I kind of, in my view, that was sort of a little bit of a tier of guys in terms of close to the majors with upside guys. So we wanted to grab him as they were sort of flying off the board. So that might've been a spot where we took a guy. I can't remember if he was the top prospect I had available or not, but we saw sort of that was coming to an end and wanted to get in on that a little bit. We also took Tyler Glass now, who's not technically a pitching prospect, but for all intents and purposes, that's exactly what he is, because he's still super risky and unproven. So, I mean, that would be our top two guys that we're kind of leaning on in that department. But there, it wasn't like we were shying away from them. Honestly, like the one pick I legitimately regret is us taking Lewis Brinson in the 7th over Forrest Whitley, who's my top pitching prospect. I wish we could have back, but other than that, I think everything kind of shook out the way I was expecting on that front.
Well, I'm pretty sure Mike and Matt got Forrest Whitley, right? Oh, no, you guys didn't.
No.
No.
I was going to say you guys could make a little trade on air, but that's not going to work. Mike, what was your thought about the whole process? Were you happy with the way your guys' team ended up? I know you joined halfway through, so you didn't have as much say early on, but Matt didn't like load up on too many Cardinals.
Yeah, my honestly, the only issue I have with the beginning before I got there was Domingo Santana, because I am not a believer in him long term. And in the third round, I think it's rich. But regardless, like if I were to enter this from the beginning, I would have pretty much projected what happened, which is you're going to have a couple of guys that are going to go way prospect heavy. And then you're also going to have an owner or two that also go the completely other way. And I always like to go right in the middle. I like to have guys that I can rely on for the foreseeable future. And I also like to take a couple of dart throws as well. I joined in the eighth round when we drafted Michael Kopech, and you know, obviously we turned around and grabbed Johnny Cueto after that. Matt Carpenter is a Cardinal, but Matt and I are completely on board with somebody like him. But we just kind of remained stable in our theme the whole draft, which was, you know, grab some veteran guys that are going to help us out for the next few years, and then also take some chances on a few guys that might be, you know, long-term great assets for us. I think Anderson Espinosa is a guy that if we were doing this draft, you know, 2 years ago or even a year ago, he would have went somewhere in the vicinity of like the seventh round, eighth round, sixth round, and we were able to grab him way later than that. So there's just a lot of value. Just has a massive difference each year in and year out, and especially with prospects. So going prospect heavy, like, you know, the guys that you mentioned earlier, Justin, I'm not going to, like, you know, just straight crush them on air or something, but that's just I've seen it in the Friends with Fantasy Benefits Dynasty draft that we originally did, which ended up founding the site. And I've seen it in any other Dynasty draft I've done. Just going prospects heavy early isn't necessarily a really good strategy to do. And we want to just remain somewhere in the middle. And I think we did a pretty good job of it. If I had to project it now based on looking at all the teams, I think we'll end up somewhere in the top like eight or nine, you know, because we do have guys that we can trade that are prospects and such that could help us compete even more. But other than Domingo Santana early, I think we did a pretty good job.
I will crush them on air only because if and when they prove me wrong, it'll be like 4 or 5 years down the road and we'll have all forgotten about this conversation.
To be fair, I have seen their current roster and their TDGX team, and it's pretty phenomenal stuff. I believe, James, you're in that league, aren't you? I think they have like Trout, Harper, Arenado, everybody. Yeah.
I mean, the key to their strategy is, like, I think it's a viable strategy if you do a couple things right. And I think they kind of botched some picks in the middle rounds. Like, I don't see how guys like, you know, I thought they got a little aggressive on guys like Dansby Swanson, J.P. Crawford, Nick Gordon, like the guys that don't have a ton of upside. If you're going to do that strategy, you got to kind of chase upside throughout. And then, like, the biggest thing, the strategy is being an active trader and winning a ton of trades on, like, so, I mean, I'm in that TDGX league with Tom. I mean, Tom's an extremely aggressive trader. Like, he'll send you, like, he'll spam you with trades left and right if he thinks that you're contemplating a rebuild. And I think that, you know, part of the reason he was able to acquire so much talent in TDGX is every time an owner was kind of ready to throw in the towel and hit the restart button, Tom was there with like three top 50 prospects for their best player and was able to get all of those big chips. So, like, it's this whole strategy hinges on him being able to pull off those same types of trades in this league. So it's not just, he's not going to just grow with all these prospects and hope that they all turn out. He's going to try to turn them into big leaguers at some point. He's probably going to keep Acuna and Vlad Jr. and Menez and Tatis, but I think the rest of them he'll be trying to swoop in when owners are ready to hit the restart button.
All right. Well, let's move on to a different subject entirely. We actually had some moves go on in the last week. We need to kind of catch up on them. And James is from Milwaukee, so are you a Brewers fan, James?
Yeah, I feel like I'm less of a fan here, but I would still qualify that as me being a fan. Yeah.
All right. Well, your team then made some huge moves this week, kind of shook things up. The Brewers traded for Christian Yelich. They gave up Lewis Brinson, Monte Harrison, Isan Diaz, and Jordan Yamamoto. What were your thoughts on the trade, and what do you think Yelich's value is going forward?
I was excited, you know. I mean, in part, just because I'm a baseball fan and nothing's been happening this whole offseason, so it was fun for there to actually be something to talk about. And it was fun that it was my team that was doing it. You know, I like Lewis Brinson a lot. I thought they picked a great time to sell on Harrison. I thought they picked an awful time to sell on Diaz. But I thought that he was because this is a team that has a lot of the pieces, not all of the pieces, but a lot of the pieces to try to contend over the next 2 or 3 years. And, you know, you aren't going to get anything from Harrison or Isan Diaz over the next 2 years. I think that's pretty safe to say. And, you know, best case scenario with Lewis Brinson, that he's a slightly lesser player than Christian Yelich, who you have under control for 5 years. So, I mean, I think it's a great move in terms of cashing in some chips, solidifying a spot that was going to be, you know, there was going to be all kinds of competition. I mean, with Phillips, Brinson, Keon Broxton, I don't know if they were going to have a steady outfielder that really took that job and ran with it this year. Now they don't really have to worry with Payne and Yelich being pieces that you're not going to displace. I think they really value outfield defense like the rest of baseball is really starting to do. And a guy like Domingo Santana and Ryan Braun, when you have those two guys in the outfield corners, your outfield defense just isn't going to be very good. So I think that was a big part of the calculus. And I still think there's another shoe to drop. I still think Domingo Santana gets dealt here in the next week or two.
Mike, what are your thoughts on this move? And what do you think Yelich's value is for 2018?
Yeah, I love this move for the Marlins. And I've been a long, long time Isan Diaz fan. I think that he is going to end up being a really good, not only fantasy player, but big leaguer as well. Yes, he is a couple years away, and I know he took a step back last year, but I'm a big fan of Diaz, so I'm in for that. I'm also in for Brinson. I've always been a fan of him. It's just a really solid baseball move for the Marlins and the Brewers alike, really. From a Yelich perspective, the home ballpark, I've heard a few people kind of give, you know, Miller Park an example of a place where Yelich could possibly inflate his home run numbers. And I just disagree. He hits the ball on the ground way too much. His 59% ground ball rate for his career is not indicative of a guy that's going to have good power metrics anywhere. It doesn't matter where he plays. Even if he was playing in Yankee Stadium, which is the best, you know, home run park for left-handed hitters, I still think we could reasonably could project him for, you know, 20 to 25 home runs. And that's being, I think, a little bit gracious. As far as going to Miller, I think that him hanging at the top of a lineup on a very good, productive team is going to help his run numbers. But last year he had 100 runs scored anyways, and, you know, still ended up being about the same as he was in 2016 in terms of value. Overall, I'm saying that I don't think his value really changes too much. He will continue to steal, which is definitely a boom for his value. I don't think he'll necessarily surpass what he's done in the last couple of seasons. His career high is 21 in 2014. He could flirt with that or even surpass it because the Brewers do like to run, especially under Craig Counsell. But overall, I think we'll see a guy that's probably going to have the same amount of home runs, runs scored, good batting average, and all of that into just a different team. And I mean, he'll probably remain a top 70-ish player, top 50-ish player. And that's pretty valuable at this point. So, yeah.
Matt, what are your take? What's your take on Yelich?
I think he's going to get that after the trade bump when his ADP, I'm sure it's already rising up on NFBC and all that and stuff. And it shouldn't. I think the ballpark is a little bit overblown. Mike touched on it 100%. If he doesn't hit more fly balls, he's not going to do much of that home run upside. He is hitting more fly balls in the last couple of years. The fly ball rate has improved. And I do think in Milwaukee, he's going to run a lot, maybe run a lot more. So maybe you're looking at, you know, 25 stolen bases as a reasonable target now for it. But I'm still not projecting that because if Milwaukee's lineup is going to be as good as we might think it might be on paper, I don't think he's going to run too much in front of those big guns. So he might, I mean, he's got 20-20 upside. I don't think he hits, you know, 20 home runs, but he's got a shot. I would settle somewhere about 18 home runs, 21 stolen bases, something like that. And he's going to put up really nice plate skills, really good walk rate. he's really underrated overall baseball player, but I think his fantasy value might be a little bit overblown right now. And, you know, we love Eisan Diaz, and he was one of our targets, Mike and I, and for RDI, and it's my fault completely.
You just had to take Tyler O'Neill. We just had to.
No, and I'm like, oh, Diaz had a bad year. He's going to slide down a little bit. And then, you know, Craig Goldstein grabbed him, and I was kind of surprised by that. But, you know, I think with Diaz, I think his fantasy value also might be a little bit overblown, only because, you know, it's going to be a few years until he comes up. But there were 6 second basemen this year that finished outside the top 20 at the position that hit 20 home runs. And I think power is pretty much the only plus skill Diaz is going to supply from a fantasy standpoint. And it's going to be a while, you know, from now, but for the position, 20 homer second baseman isn't what it used to be. So I think his fantasy value might be a little overblown, but I like the deal overall for really both teams. I mean, it fits the narrative with what Miami's had going on this offseason. And they, now if they just need to trade Real Muto and complete the offseason for them.
Well, and Justin Bour, they need to get rid of him. And Starlin Castro. They need to get
rid
of anything.
Those two guys aren't.
And that fish statue.
Yeah, they can keep the fish statue.
I'm in lockstep with you guys. I think, while I love the move from a baseball sense for both teams, I don't necessarily think Yelich's value goes up a ton, if really at all. I can't imagine that I'm putting him in front of AJ Pollock or, maybe Pollock, because I probably had a Pollock already, but not in front of Tommy Pham, not in front of Billy Hamilton, not in front of Starling Marte. So, like, there were people on Twitter, people in the industry I respect a lot, saying that this would move him up to a top 10 outfielder. And in terms of ADP, that's Andrew Benintendi, who's going as the 42nd player overall. That's insane to me. The guy still hits 55% ground balls. His profile is not going to change that much being in Milwaukee. The lineup he's in isn't actually any better than the top half of the lineup was last year in Miami. I mean, Miami had a fantastic lineup last year with Ozuna going off, with Stanton winning the MVP, D. Gordon. I can't imagine this lineup being that much more beneficial to a guy like Yelich. I don't see him as a huge burner, so I don't think we're talking about a guy who's going to be stealing 30 bases. We're definitely not talking about a guy who's hitting 25 to 30 home runs. So I think people are overly excited, as a lot of us are, that just things are happening in free agency in the hot stove. And they're applying that to his draft value, which I think is a bad process. Let's talk real quick about Lewis Brinson, because I think there's some questions about whether or not or when Brinson will be up full-time as a player with the Marlins. I'm of the opinion that he's going to start the year in AAA. The Marlins have no real reason to bring him up except for maybe as a new face of the franchise. James, what are your thoughts on Lewis Brinson's arrival time?
I'm with you. I haven't done the math on it, but I assume they'll just keep him down until they get that extra year of control, which will probably be, first, second week of May, something like that. So I think that's exactly what this is. Not. I mean, just because the rest of their outfield sucks doesn't mean they're going to sacrifice the year of control just to get a name everyone's heard of in there. I mean, they're nobody's going to those games, whether Lewis Brinson's playing or not. So I think early May. I do think his value is a bit more stable, though, than it was before the trade, because at least we know, you know, come early May at the latest, he's going to be up playing today. He's not going to be jerked out of an everyday role if he goes on like a 1-for-20 skid, which might have been the case in Milwaukee. So I think it's good, especially in the short term, just because no one's going to be put there.
Mike, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think that he's going to end up getting that extra year of control, which, you know, ETA will probably be somewhere around May. And I think that, I mean, nobody's really drafting him in fantasy much. If they are, they're taking like a late round flyer on him. And I agree with that. I think that's well worth, you know, using a last round, you know, draft pick on a guy that has always been pretty solid in the minors in terms of what he can offer fantasy wise in the power and speed department. And, you know, will more than likely get a full-time role the rest of the way. I also agree with the role itself. In Milwaukee, if he ended up having a bad skid, he would have ended up, you know, probably back in the minors or in a, you know, lesser role itself. And, you know, overall, I did like the park, obviously, better in Miller Park long term, but I don't think it'll really affect his overall profile that much as well. I think we can expect him to be, you know, a 15 to 20 ish home run guy regardless, and somebody that can also steal bases as well. I'm more concerned about the plate skills long term, kind of being a guy that just is obsessed with plate skills. He, you know, especially in his MLB exposure last year and the last couple of years, hasn't really impressed me in that department. So I'm hoping that, you know, he gets some coaching in and stuff to be better in that area. But overall, I agree. I think that Brinson will probably be up and up to stay somewhere around May. And I know, just to touch on a Monte Harrison point that James made earlier, we talked about it earlier, talking about the AFL, Matt and I, and I just do not believe in Harrison. I agree that he should have been a nice little piece in this deal, but a lot of prospect guys are really high on Harrison based on what he did last year in the AFL, and I'm not really sold on him long term at all at this point. So if you're in a very deep keeper dynasty league and you think Harrison gets a bump because his ETA might be faster, I would just kind of disregard that.
Matt, where are you at on this?
I'm locked up with you guys on the beginning of May or whatever it takes for the Marlins to secure next year of control for Brinson. I don't know if you, Justin, you remember the Brewers prospect pod. We kind of talked about Brinson was in a weird spot because you don't really want to send him back to Colorado Springs, right, in AAA. And one of his big things was working on the plate skills and stuff. But Colorado Springs, for those not familiar, is probably the most offensive-heavy AAA park besides Vegas. And with a guy as aggressive as Brinson, it's really hard to get a guy to rein in the plate skills while he's at a park like that because the ball flies out of there. Here's his home splits at Colorado Springs last year. 374, 441, 638. His OPS is over 1,000. At home and at Colorado Springs. So it's good to get him out of that environment, going to AAA New Orleans with the Marlins, and he'll kind of sit there for a while and come up in the beginning of May. So actually, we'll actually get a better picture of what Brinson could be, I think, with the play skills and see where the true play skills sit in a neutral environment. And his Major League Cup of Coffee last year didn't go well. I'm still very much betting on the power speed package. He's going to go as far as the hit tool allows him to, though, and that's going to be the big thing, and hopefully you'll get more clarity on that this year. It's not a better situation for Brinson. I mean, going to Milwaukee, anytime you go to a contending team to a non-contending team is never a good thing. But in this, I mean, now Brinson is the centerpiece of the franchise and has an everyday role secured eventually. In Milwaukee, that was still kind of questionable because they can never really find a ticket for Braun. Now they kind of don't really want to move him. Then they got Santana. Then they got Yelich and Kane. So he was very blocked, you know. So it's a good move for him. But we'll find out more of who he is in the first couple months of the season.
All right. I need you guys to give me the 411 on Jordan Yamamoto because I have no idea who he is. I'm pretty sure I had him down as Robert Yamamoto in the rundown before we started this, and James had to correct me. So, Matt, give me a rundown on Jordan Yamamoto.
Guy they got from, he was a 12th round pick in 2014. Kid from Hawaii. Not the first Brewers pitching prospect from Hawaii. They took Cody Medeiros as well. Strikeout per inning guy, probably a back end guy at the best. I mean, he had good, better strikeout numbers in 2016. They kind of fell backwards a little bit in 2017, and the walks went up. So that's something to look at. But I think for fantasy, he's not much to be concerned about. He's a better real-life asset for the Marlins because he's quality pitching depth, kind of similar to like a Zach Gallen. Probably not as polished as a Zach Gallen type from they got from the Cardinals in that trade, but you know he's a swingman type. James might be a little higher on him being a Brewers prospect, but that's kind of where I'm sitting about Yamamoto.
James, what are your thoughts on Yamamoto?
I had him, so I was in the process of doing the NL Central picks at the time of this trade. I had Yamamoto as their 23rd third best prospect for fantasy purposes. I think he is just inside the top 15 for the Marlins, which isn't saying a ton. They still lack impressive depth in that system. But yeah, I mean, I think everything matters. I mean, maybe if the changeup really develops in the next year or two, maybe he's a number four starter, but that's really where his ceiling is capped. It's more likely that on a normal club, he would be a number five or a swing man. But on this club where Dylan Peters is going to be like a number three, then he might be better than that. I mean, everything's relative with the Marlins right now, but for fantasy, he's just not interesting at all.
All right. Let's move over to the other Milwaukee move. That was signing Lorenzo Cain, which made for a really exciting day because I'm pretty sure, if I'm remembering correctly, both these happened on the same day. And it
within like an hour of each other.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was just I was going. That's right. I'd been up all day without any sleep, and I was just going insane trying to.
Well, that's every day for you, so that's not anything.
This is true. it's an interesting move because it really complicates the roster in terms of the starting lineup and the outfield, because now they have a ton of outfielders. So I'll start with you this time, Matt. What are your thoughts on Lorenzo Cain in Milwaukee, and what the hell does it mean for Domingo Santana, Brett Phillips, Ryan Braun, and Keon Broxton?
It's a cloudy picture for sure. But I think what it does for the Brewers, though, it changes him and Yelich change that whole offense. They go from being one of the most strikeout-prone clubs in the majors to, you know, Cain and Yelich, who have contact rates up over 80%. They're going to be in the front of the lineup. They both have, you know, 25 stolen base upside. Cain actually had 26 last season with 15 home runs. Their upsides are very similar. I think I really like this move for Milwaukee. And 580 is kind of what the Cardinals are paying Dexter Fowler, and I think I'd rather have Lorenzo Cain. As far as, you know, Keon Broxton, I think this has to push him off the roster. I expect him probably get traded in spring training for a relief piece or something. I saw they signed Matt Albers today. That they're going to need more than that. Ryan Braun, I read the sexy rumor he might be playing second base.
Oh, yeah. Get it.
So, hey, I'm all for I'm all for anybody getting second base eligibility except for Rizzo, because that's stupid. But I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. But you know, and Domingo Santana, I like the idea that was floated out there of Santana for Danny Salazar for Cleveland. That makes a lot of sense for both teams. So I, you know, that'd be kind of cool. But I think something's got to give there with Santana and Braun. One of those two has to be off the roster, I would think, because Braun at second base can't be a realistic thing. You know, he's a pretty bad third baseman. So I doubt we see that experiment. But it's definitely a crowded picture, and Broxton's value is has to drop significantly. And I think you can kind of hold Braun and Santana kind of in the neutral holding pattern for now and kind of see what unfolds.
James, what are your thoughts on Cain in Milwaukee and then the clusterfuck that is the Brewers offense right now?
I mean, I think Matt hit on, you know, a lot of the positives that Cain brings. Just as a fan, it's nice to have legitimate, you know, first and second hitters in a big league lineup. I mean, last year they were leading off like Eric Thames at times. They were leading off Eric Sogard, Jonathan Villar. I mean, they didn't have anything that really resembled a big league leadoff hitter. And now they have two of those guys. So that's nice to have. You know, Brett Phillips has always been a fourth outfielder to me. So this doesn't really change his outlook at all. Keon does have a minor league option remaining, which is weird to say about as he is, but I think that he, you know, I think him and Phillips probably compete in spring training for who's going to break camp as the fourth outfielder, and the other guy goes to AAA and just is a depth piece in the short term. I think Santana, you know, I would still put the odds at like 90% that Santana gets dealt, just because, you know, I think one of the big motivations for making this trade was to improve the outfield defense. Santana's bat is still probably one of the three or four best on the team. So if you didn't trade him, it'd be kind of weird to just keep subbing in for him in the sixth and seventh inning. So I think, you know, Cleveland's an option. I think if the Red Sox want to stick it to Scott Boras, I think the Red Sox are an option. If they just keep balking, try some JD Martinez. I think the Rays are still in play, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be for a guy like Chris Archer. It could be one of their other starters. I think it's got to be the AL, though, for Santana. I think that outfield defense has just never been stressed to this level before, and I really struggle to find the NL team that is so far behind the curve that they would be down to give Santana everyday reps in the outfield when Milwaukee clearly doesn't want to do that.
Well, Cubs give Schwarber reps in the outfield, so.
The Giants.
Well, the Giants would be a great fit, but they don't have anything that I can imagine the Brewers wanting in return.
Yeah, I know. That's
the, hey, that's give me Helio Ramos all day.
Yeah, the Giants aren't going to let him go, though, unfortunately.
No.
I would make that deal. Like, you know, but I'm the guy who will sell the prospect farms for a championship. So, you know, I would be more than happy for them to trade for really any of those outfielders, you know. But because right now we're looking at a Gorky's Hernandez and Austin Jackson duo in center. So, you know, yeah. Anyways. Enough about my depressing life as a Giants fan. I agree with you guys. I think Domingo Santana, I think maybe two of these pieces, Domingo Santana and either Keon Broxton or Brett Phillips, get moved at some point before the start of the season. I think we're only like 2 weeks away from pitchers and catchers reporting, so I think it's going to happen fairly soon. I love Lorenzo Cain in Milwaukee. While I don't think that Yelich gets a huge boost, I think moving from Kauffman Stadium to Miller Park is a huge boon to Lorenzo Cain's value. And I just took him, I think, 76th overall in my NFBC league. One, because I needed some speed, and all the speedy guys in that area went, and I wasn't going to get to pick for another 30 picks. But two, because I've been a huge Lorenzo Cain fan for a long time. Showed health last year. The Brewers are going to do, you know, they've already talked about making sure they give him regular days off so that way he can stay healthy. I think Cain is going to be a fantastic addition to this team and a fantastic addition to any fantasy team that takes him. Currently going around pick 90 in NFBC leagues, and I think that is going to continue to rise as we move on.
Do you think there's any truth, James? Do you think there's any truth to the Ryan Braun second base thing, or is it kind of just posturing to maybe get him to accept the trade?
Because I know he's got no trade. Jokingly, didn't he?
No, I thought it was maybe I misread it.
It was Braun talking to media members. I think it was partly in jest. You know, he
right.
relationship with Adonacio and with Council, and I think he actually wants to stay. And he's got a full no trade, so
10-5 guy, right?
One of the only teams that he was previously willing to waive that no trade for was the Marlins, so that he crossed them off. And then I think he'd waive one to the Dodgers, Ryan Braun and Matt Kemp, and then I could see him waiving one to the Padres. I mean, they were in on which would have moved Will Myers to the outfield. So if they want to just take a guy like Ryan Braun to plug one of those holes, I could maybe see the Padres being a fit, but I honestly think the whole Ryan Braun first base, Ryan Braun second base, like, to me, that's just posturing by the team so that they can try to preserve some, you know, when they're talking trade with these teams, I assume a lot of teams are just going to be like, well, you have to trade Santana, so we're not going to give you full price. So I think that's partly what some of this Ryan Braun to first base thing is just kind of say, hey, no, we actually like Braun at first base. I mean, I really don't think they want to do that. I know Jesus Aguilar fell off in the second half, but I think they'd much rather just go with the platoon of Aguilar and Thames at first base and give Braun like a day or two off each week in the outfield to try to keep him fresh.
I always love that where people are like, well, they've got to trade him, so they're going to trade him at a reduced rate. They don't have to trade him to you. Like, whenever a guy like comes to me and goes, oh, you got a glut of pitching, you know, you should trade him. Here, I'm going to give you 75 cents on the dollar. I don't have to trade him to you. I can trade him to someone else who's going to give me full price. So, yeah, the whole posturing thing, it just seems ridiculous. The idea that they're going to put a guy like Ryan Braun at second base just is absolutely laughable to me. I think it's insane. But it's fun to talk about because of the free agency not picking up, we have nothing else to talk about. Unless you guys want to talk about Brandon Moss real quick, what did he get traded for?
I have no idea.
It was Brandon Moss and Ryan Buchter for
Jesse Hahn. I know it was involved.
Jesse Hahn and Heath Phillmeyer, the pitching prospect.
Jeffrey Flanagan. All right. Well, with that, we're just going to wrap up a little bit early.
Well, wait, you didn't let me get my take in on this trade. What the fuck?
Sorry.
Messed up, dude.
I'm so not used to you being here that I totally forgot you were here. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'll make it quick. How about that? Well, if you look at the Brewers, they obviously have a pitching need. They have to land one of Alex Cobb or Yu Darvish, in my opinion, or they need to trade. They're definitely going to. I agree, like 90% chance that Domingo Santana gets traded. 0% chance Ryan Braun plays second base ever in the history of baseball will that happen. But Lorenzo Cain, like, I think is going to get overdrafted. And the reason why is everybody's so used to him being somewhat durable and offering some speed. And, like, this is a guy that's dealt with multiple lower body injuries. Yes, he does offer a lot defensively, but for fantasy purposes, he really worries me because I do think he's going to start skyrocketing ADP-wise. And I think it's just a crime that Ryan Braun is going on average 112th behind Cain, because like Braun, I think has a ton left in the tank for him. I think that he has the ability to once again be, you know, 2 years straight prior to 2017, he was a $30 earner in Roto. I think that he's going to rebound, and I just don't understand why he keeps on slipping and falling. I mean, I understand if people have down years, it happens, but Braun is a big winner here without even actually winning, because people will just like not really notice that he's still a stud of a player because of all the trade talks and all this stuff. But they have to trade for a pitching, for some type of either pitching depth that can help them now, or they need to grab a guy off free agency. Something needs to happen. I agree about Brett Phillips and all of that. But overall, like, the biggest take here is I don't think Cain will be as good as everybody thinks. And I think Braun is going to be one of the biggest winners of all this.
Well, here, you know, this is why I skip you when it's your turn, because you say insane things like Lorenzo.
But
Cain.
Am I right? A lot of times, I think I am.
No, I am. It's just not. Ryan Braun hasn't had a 600 plate appearance season since 2012. Lorenzo Cain has had two in the last 3 years.
First off, Ryan Braun has 500 at bats three of the last 4 years. I look at at bats, not plate appearances. But I mean, the durability thing is something that I can even push aside. With Cain last year, I think his power was inflated. Also, his speed score was mad inflated. Like, the year before, yes, he was injured. He had a terrible speed score. But last year, in 2017, was a career high overall in speed opportunities, speed score. So, like, he was given the full-on green light. I just don't know if that's the – there's really nowhere to go but down in Milwaukee. I don't think he will steal more. He'll probably steal a ton still, but I don't – see him being a possible. I mean, how many stolen bases did Cain have last year? 26. I mean, what is he going to possibly go up to 30? Like, that's not a massive difference. And home runs wise, you might get a couple more. But that's the thing, is when you bake in the durability concerns and the fact that, like, he's mainly a batting average guy with double digit home runs and 20 plus stolen bases. You know, I just don't really see like where he gets that much better just because of a park. It just doesn't make sense to me. And it's only advantageous for left-handed batters. Like, left-handed batters, Miller Park is the second best stadium in all of baseball. But for righties, it's not like it's the best thing ever. It's not going to boost him in some massive way. Also, going to a completely different league in the National League where he's going to have to learn an entirely different crop of pitchers. I just don't think that this is some massive boom to his value. I don't get it.
The Brewers are tied with the most stolen bases in the last three seasons.
Where is Kansas City ranked? Kansas City last year fell 12th, but for the last 3 years, they are first.
Yeah, I don't – he's going to be leading off on a much better lineup. I don't understand the idea that Cain's value doesn't tick up. But I don't know. James, what do you think? Who's right here? Pick your friend.
Braun or Cain?
I dig where he's coming from on the Braun thing, just in the sense that I think right now would be a perfect time to let him ball to you in a slow draft. If, you know, people are overreacting to this and assuming that his playing time is going to get like cut in half or whatever. I do think there's a bit of a bounce back looming for a guy like Braun, but I also am wary about the plate appearances. I think that he gets over 20 home runs again. Was down to just 17 last year. I think that he gets back a little bit there, but I mean, the speed probably continues to tick down. So I'd buy the idea that his value might be a little low for this like 2 or 3 week period where we're not sure what the doing. But I mean, with Kane and Yelich, it's just a mess for me. Like I love both those guys. I liked them before the trade. I like them now. If it's creeping up into the 50s or whatever for a guy like Kane, then I'm probably out. But in the 60s, 70s, that's fine.
Matt, what are your thoughts?
I'll keep it quick. I think it's Lorenzo Cain for me, but I understand where Mike's coming from, and I also agree with James on his last statement there. I think Braun is going to be a hell of a buy low candidate in slow drafts because, like you said, people assume he's the odd man out, but I mean he's making too much money, and he's been productive enough not to be the odd man out in Milwaukee. So I still go Cain, and it's going to depend on how much he's going to boost because every guy that gets traded. ADP always soars up. It's Kane for now, but in a week from now, it might be Braun because I think he's the ADP is going to drop.
All right. Well, let that be the last word because Mike is wrong.
Actually, Justin, one more thing.
Yes.
You see who the Giants signed today?
Oh, please just stop it. We already went over this in the pod I did earlier.
That's awesome. Oh my gosh.
Didn't see that. My bad.
The new listeners have no idea about my right. Lifelong
Blanco love.
Yeah, my vendetta against Gregor Blanco, but that's for another podcast. We won't bore James with the story of how Gregor Blanco screwed me out of a Dynasty League championship by one run on the final day. that's going to wrap us up. James, why don't you remind people again, we can reach on social media and then plug all your stuff over at RotoWire.
Yeah, you can reach me at RealJRAnderson on Twitter. And if you go to rotowire.com/pod, you'll get a free 10-day trial. You don't have to submit a credit card or anything like that. And you can read my work that way. I have the top 400 prospects. I'm also pumping out a pretty big article each week here between now and opening day. So definitely a good place to get all your baseball stuff.
Definitely worth the money over there at RotoWire. I know Matt, I and Mike are all subscribers there. I love the draft software. I think it's one of the best in the business. And we love all the guys over there, Clay and Derek and Vlad, Jason, you got Todd, you guys all do a fantastic job over there. So definitely go check out all the stuff, especially James's stuff over at rotowire.com. Mike, what are you working on? Where can people reach you?
Yeah, reach me on Twitter at Mike Werner, FWFB, finishing up some stuff for the draft guide, finishing up some stuff for the Fangraphs player capsules. I'm going to do daily matchups column for Baseball HQ this year. I'm going to continue to do multiple podcasts for this whenever I get time off work, which is kind of rare. But I'm also going to continue to track Lorenzo Cain versus Ryan Braun because I'm really kind of bugged out by this. So, but thank you, James, for coming on. You're the man. You're a stud with the prospects. And I hope more and more people will get to find out about you and your work because you crush it every day.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Going to be fun competing against you in the RotoWire Dynasty Invitational. I'm sure you guys are going to have great showings this year.
I'm going to crush you all in that. Matt, where are you reached? What are you working on?
First of all, James, thank you for the invitation to the Invitational, and thanks for coming on today. I love your stuff. MD Top FWFB on Twitter, wrapping up the prospect pods, going system by system with my man Justin. Sometimes he got Ben. I've also had Mike this year with me, so it's been a little bit different this year, but always fun doing those, wrapping those up here shortly. Look for the draft guide stuff. All my content will be in there.
And you can reach me on Twitter at Justin Mason, FWFB. Email me or the show, friendsoffantasybenefits@gmail.com. You can read all my stuff at friendsoffantasybenefits.com, at Fangraphs, at Fantasy Alarm, Fantrax. Listen to me on the Fantasy Sports Radio Network, on the Great Fantasy Baseball Podcast, on Sleeper in the Bust. Am I forgetting anything? I work too much.
You just say Sleeper in the Bust?
Yeah.
What?
I'm on Sleeper in the Bust. I'm just producing right now, but you know, that may change here pretty quickly. So I don't know. Maybe I'll just tease something and leave that out in the air and see what happens. So, and then Mike and I announced earlier this week that I'm in Tout Wars. That's awesome. And I'm doing the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational, which is fantastic. Please go look at more because I believe, James, you're in the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational, right?
Yeah.
That's right. Everybody on this podcast in the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational, leagues are officially set, and I will be sending out invites to everybody, and I will be revealing them on the next Great Fantasy Baseball podcast. So definitely tune in for that. And that will wrap us up for this episode. For James, Mike, Matt, and myself, thank you for listening. Have a fantastic baseball season.